Hello, and welcome to Viewpoints, a weekly program of information on the ever-changing world of accessibility. Now here are the hosts of this program, Nancy Goodman-Torpy and Peter Torpy.
Hello, I'm Nancy.
And I'm Pete. On this week's show, we have an incredible story of a visually impaired hiker who hiked over 2,000 miles up the east coast of the United States on the Appalachian Trail.
Carl Ritter has very little vision and did the first 500 miles alone. Learn how he used his other senses and some tools to compensate for his lack of vision. But first for our tip of the week. This week's tip comes from Carl Ritter.
The technology, I think, is one of the things that is just so absolutely amazing about what's happening right now. I think it's one of the great reasons why the blind visually impaired community needs to stay connected to one another, is because one person will hear about some technology, and you know, when you're talking to your blind visually impaired friends, and the topic of technology always comes up, and somebody's always heard of a device or a product or has figured out a workaround for something, and I think that that's one of the things that's bringing the community together.
Although most of Carl's hike was certainly lower tech in terms of trudging through woods and camping and hiking, he also did make use of some high-tech equipment that he'll tell you about later on. But, you know, we try to keep in touch in this show with new accessible technology that makes things easier for visually impaired people to do. And it is important to keep track of these things. Of course, they can be very helpful at times.
And because what's available keeps changing. And also, many people with low vision, their vision isn't stable over time. So after another 5 or 10 years and your vision's changed, you might need some new equipment to help you accommodate to that. And so it's important to keep track of what's available. Turning now to our low-tech item, we'll meet Carl Ritter, also known as Bats. Can you start by introducing yourself?
My name is Carl Ritter, and most of my hiking friends know me as Bat because everybody on the trail gets a trail name, and that happens to be mine due to my low vision, and I live in Washington State.
Can you describe the cause of your low vision and the nature of it?
My vision has never been defined what causes it, but my retinas are dying, somewhat similar to retinitis pigmentosa. However, I'm also severely nearsighted. I was a minus 30 diopters before they started changing lenses and corneas and whatnot on my eyes. There is no name for it, though.
Can you quantify, like, when you lost your vision or when it started degrading?
Yeah, I used to be able to see much better. I did drive. Now, in retrospect, I don't think I ever really should have driven. Or if I did drive, I probably only should have ever driven during the daytime. Because the doctors couldn't see that there were anything wrong with my retinas other than detachments and whatnot they had growing up, they couldn't see that the nerves weren't firing.
So in terms of functionality, I mean, we're going to be talking to you about hiking in the woods. How much stuff do you think you can actually see? You know, if you're out in the woods, can you see what's on the ground that you might need to step over?
I can't see all the way to the ground. I'm 6 feet tall, and so if I were only about 4 feet tall, I could see all the way to the ground. It wouldn't be as big of an issue, but at my height, it's too far for me to actually see. But I do see gross objects out of the center of my vision, specifically out of one eye. And so it gives me an idea. However, I don't have the definition, and my pupils don't change much, so I have difficulty going from light to dark. So as we're talking about walking, it's much easier for me to walk through the woods when it's completely shadowed, and I'm not dealing with bright, dark, where sometimes in broken canopy, it's actually more difficult for me because when I step in the bright, it's too bright, and the shadows are too dark. I have a much more difficult time figuring out what's actually out there.
Do you read print books?
I listen to all of my books as audiobooks anymore. I could read print in certain fonts and in certain lighting situations, but I read so slowly as a print reader that it's just not enjoyable, and I can't do it for that long in a day. So I love to read too much to actually be a print reader anymore.
And I take it since the degradation happened later in life, you probably don't read Braille?
I have learned Braille up to a certain point, and then because of events in my life and moving and changing and whatnot, I haven't finished my Braille, and Braille's just not as easy for me to carry around, you know, when I travel, and so just having one little phone with me that carries 200 audiobooks with it, it's so amazing and awesome for me, and I can listen with one headphone in as I'm walking and out of my other ear, just stay aware of my surroundings and listening for the cues that I get that way.
And we'll talk about Carl's one little phone later on.
You are listening to Viewpoints.
This week's focus topic is long-distance hiking for the visually impaired. Pete and I really enjoy being out in the woods, and we often go for hikes in various conditions, and on a long day, maybe we'll cover 6 or 8 miles. Well, Carl averaged almost 3 times that every day for months on end as he hiked the Appalachian Trail.
It's hard to imagine.
How did you get into hiking?
Well, I spent a lot of years as a rock climber. I spent about 15 years as a rock climber. As a kid, I was in Boy Scouts and did lots of camping, did a trip to Philmont Scout Ranch where we did a 100-mile trip over 10 days. So I've always been doing things outdoorsy. As my vision continued to decrease, the rock climbing wasn't an issue for going up. Going up was easy. You know, my arms didn't get farther than my eyesight away from me, so I could see the handholds. And as I passed things, I just kind of memorized the rock, and I put my feet where I assumed that the foothold should be, and sometimes, you know, took a little feeling around, but I did it. But I was holding all my climbing partners back. When we would get to the top of something, you typically walk down a trail. You don't actually go back down the rock face you went up. And when I go downhill, the ground's even further away from my eyes. And so walking downhill just started becoming so slow and laborious and difficult and at times frightening that I moved away from rock climbing. And I started figuring out other things to do. I joined a bowling league. I did a number of other things, started playing a lot more disc golf. And then the logical progression was, well, I'm good at walking, so I guess I'll take up backpacking and long-distance hiking again.
It's interesting you should talk about having more difficulty going down even though you were walking. You know, Nancy and I go on quite a few hikes than I don't mind going up because I've always felt you can't fall up, but I'm always more wary coming down.
Exactly. When I go uphill, the ground is closer, so I do have a better chance of seeing it, especially as it gets quite a bit steeper. But you're right, you know, when you fall uphill, you don't fall as far. But falling downhill is always the scary fall to take, and that's when you usually end up getting hurt more.
We have listeners from around the world, and they may not be familiar with what the Appalachian Trail is. Can you describe the trail a little bit and what's involved?
The trail is a footpath that goes from Georgia to the state of Maine. This year, it was 2,184 miles long, which is approximately 3,500 kilometers. You walk through the woods. You may be able to hear a road or see a road. Sometimes that's a dirt road. Sometimes a paved road. Sometimes it's an interstate. But you are in the woods walking down a path, and it's narrow. I would say typically it is foot to a foot and a half wide. There are 3 long-distance trails in the United States, the Appalachian Trail being almost 2,200 miles, Pacific Crest Trail on the west coast, 2,600 miles, and the Continental Divide, which is on the eastern side of the Rocky Mountains, is 3,000 miles long. So it's the shortest. However, it also has the most elevation gain and loss of any of those trails. It's a lot of up and down. The East Coast doesn't have a lot of soil, so where this trail's been running for years, there's a lot of rocks, a lot of ruts.
I'm kind of curious. You said you started out alone, and I'm wondering, you know, when I hike with Nancy, I can't see, and I rely on her vision to pick up the trail markers and to not get us off course. How do you manage that?
So when I started out, I was alone. There are white markers on the trees. They are 2 inches wide, 6 inches tall. Perfect rectangles that we call blazes. And they're on the trees, and they indicate that you're on the trail. The things that, in the start, get me more thrown off than anything else is I'm very much paying attention to the ground and the leaves. When I started out on February 28th, there were no leaves on the trees, but there were leaves on the ground. And there had been almost 100 people that had walked ahead of me on the trail intending to do the entire trail, as well as day hikers. So when I was walking, if the leaves crunched, then I had to start becoming aware I probably was not on the trail. As long as I was stepping on leaves, but they didn't crunch, it was a good indication I was going the right way.
Were you able to see the white trail markers?
I can see them sometimes. It depends which way the light's going and how close I get to them.
So you're really relying mostly on tactile and sound senses?
Mm-hmm. And the number one thing that throws me off, especially in the beginning, are what we call the water bars, where they're trying to prevent erosion. So they will put a piece of wood across the trail, kind of at a diagonal, to channel the water off of the trail. And those commonly build up with leaves. And all the time I would be walking down the trail, and I would hit one of those, and I would turn. Of course, I'd only make it two steps or so, and I'm like, oh, this is really crunchy. I took another water bar. I just walked back up the hill a little bit, get back on the trail, and continue walking. But those things always throw me off at the start.
So you also mentioned the other day when we were setting up the interview that you didn't use a dog. I presume you don't use a cane. What other aids get you through all this?
Right. I have used two seeing eye dogs over my years in my regular life, and I do use a cane. Currently, my last dog retired before I started hiking the trail. He was too old to do the entire trail, and so I did it without him. I use two trekking poles that I am essentially using as my canes. Instead of using one cane, I use two. Helps with the balance, allows me to probe ahead of me. It allows me to feel ahead, especially when I'm going downhill. And then it gives you the added push when you follow through, using it as like a cross-country skier would to propel you uphill or on the flat. But I do feel ahead with my trekking poles.
Oh, I see. So at least you have some feedback on the trail. So you also talked about hitting your head on some low-hanging trees. Do you use any head protection or ways of getting around that?
I really should. Just like in the real world, for all of us that are tall that use a cane, one of the things I loved about using my dogs is they could alert me to the overhead obstacles. But using a cane, I hit my head in the real world, and using my trekking poles, I hit my head hiking the trail as well. And I hit my head hard enough because I walk quite quickly. I just have a long stride, and I can really get going. And when I'm staring straight down at the ground, my vision's so tunneled, I don't see the trees that have fallen there across the trail, and I whack right into them with my head. I probably should at some point move to some sort of padding to protect it, but I guess that would require me to have hit my head less times and maybe still have those brain cells working.
So Pete follows me, but I'm a couple of inches shorter, and there have been some instances when he wound up less than happy with my guidance. I've learned over the years that I need to tell him to duck even if I don't.
I hiked for about 1,700 miles. I met a woman on the trail, and she and I just hit it off and realized we were real compatible hiking speed-wise and personality-wise. So we hiked about 1,700 miles together. And for the probably at least the last 1,000, maybe even 1,400 miles, she most of the time walked ahead of me and she started alerting me. But it is hard because we were 6-7 inches different in height. And so sometimes, you know, she was just walking, and after 20 miles of walking, you are a little less aware of your surroundings. And if you didn't have to duck at all, sometimes you forget to tell somebody else. And so, yep, I completely understand Pete's difficulty with your guiding.
Good thing you're understanding about it. He isn't always. When he whacks his head, he sometimes gets testy.
She's gotten good at patching me up with Steri-Strips, though.
And, you know, super glue works really well. It burns a little at first, but it does wonders for putting wounds back together.
We've gotten that advice from our medical friends, but haven't tried that. But I hear that's good.
It is, but it really does burn. So avoid it if you can.
So you've had some serious accidents at times, I take it.
I have. Last year, I sprained one of my ankles quite badly by stepping on a rock that I didn't know was there and just rolling an ankle, and it just happens. I mean, everybody who hikes, I think, sprains ankles to some extent, but that one last year was a pretty good one. This year, I certainly rolled my ankles a number of times. They just seemed to have become stronger and didn't cause the same injuries as last year. Took a couple falls, got cut up on those. Nothing severe, never had to get any stitches this year. But yeah, I definitely got scraped up, beat up. I didn't look like I had been hanging out in an office, that's for sure.
What do you recommend keeping with you in terms of first aid?
That's a tricky one because I really feel like that it depends on who you are and what kind of injuries you typically get. Some people, when they fall, they split themselves open just to drop a hat. I don't know why their skin splits easier, but I always like having duct tape because you can fix nearly anything with it. And if you carry enough duct tape, you can, you know, use a shirt and duct tape a bandage onto yourself. I always carry super glue because you can fix things with that. Or if you have one of those really deep cuts that needs stitches, you can shoot the super glue in there and pinch your skin together and it'll seal itself right up. Band-aids, I always like to carry some aspirin, ibuprofen. We call it vitamin I. All the long-distance hikers, we basically eat ibuprofen every day to keep the inflammation down. Oh, gosh. Beyond that, the former Boy Scout. I used to carry a whole lot of things kind of in preparation. And over the years, I've spent enough time outdoors that I figure I can figure out how to rig together a splint, you know, and crawl around and grab some sticks if I needed to and duct tape them onto my leg or my arm and make that splint. I can make a sling out of my bandana or a shirt. Because I've done it enough times, I feel like I can improvise with what I have.
You've hiked hundreds and hundreds and thousands of miles. What kind of advice would you give a visually impaired person about what kind of trails to attempt when they're beginners or any other kind of advice that you might have?
The first thing that I would suggest is learn how to get your pack weight down as low as possible. Because we don't have the ability to understand exactly what our terrain is, if you're going to roll an ankle, you want to have as little weight on your back as possible. I'm a 190-pound, 6-foot guy, so I'm a big guy. And my pack was typically about 22, 23 pounds. On my next hike, it will hopefully be a little bit under 20 pounds. And that's with my food, my water, my tent, clothing, everything in it. So by having less weight, you're just less likely to get injured. When you do make those missteps, you're able to recover better. And so that's number one. Number two, if you can get your pack weight really low, then you can move from, instead of walking around in a giant clunky boot, which takes away that tactile sensation we get through our feet, you can move back to something more like a trail runner, which still allows you to place your foot and feel and get some feedback. A lot of people say, well, boots protect my ankles and keep me from rolling my ankles. That may be true. If it is for you, wear a boot. But I would really encourage people to try going out in more of a trail runner and see the difference of how it is when you put your foot down, you can actually feel the ground. Next thing I would suggest, get a set of dirty trekking poles. Don't try to save weight there because we use our trekking poles completely different than what most people do. Possibly even carry a spare because we use them so hard. Carbon fiber breaks, go aluminum. You may bend it, but who cares? They're less expensive. You can replace them, whatever. Just grab a set of those. Having a guide with you is so much easier. It just makes it so much less frustrating, makes it less scary. It just increases your enjoyment of the experience. You know, you can ask somebody not to talk to you other than tell you what's around you if you want to feel more isolated. And then the last thing I would say is find trails that are really friendly to walk on, things that aren't covered with rocks and tree roots. The trails we have out west are substantially different than the trails we have on the east. Out west, they tend to be wider, they tend to be smoother, they tend to be graded more friendly with a lot more switchbacks and things like that. The East Coast throws all those fist-sized rocks at you, and they're much more difficult to walk on for me. And so I would definitely encourage people, or heck, go to the desert, you know, walk through the sand. It's not as bad to fall in the sand unless you hit a cactus.
We've done that too. I've grabbed cactuses going up some of those mountains looking for something to hold on to.
Yeah.
That's how we first started including a pair of tweezers in our first aid kit when Pete grabbed his first cactus and, of course, got a thorn stuck in him. We didn't have tweezers, but fortunately some other hiker came along and said, oh, here, I can help you use my tweezers.
Do you feel safe walking alone along the trail?
The Appalachian Trail is walked by so many people every year that if you're leaving at any normal time of year, you're not alone. I left on the very early side of the time of year you would depart. If I would have left 2-3 weeks later, at any point in time, if I would have felt like I was lost or anything, but I still felt like I was on the trail, I could have sat down. The longest stretch I can even imagine would be maybe 30 minutes to an hour, and somebody would have walked by me. I didn't carry maps for 90, 95% of the trail at all, just because it's so obvious where the trail is. And if you're off of it, you're walking through crunchy leaves, you're walking through a lot of underbrush. There's too many branches down at body level. So you don't make it far when you start going off trail and you're like, this just doesn't make sense. They wouldn't send us through this. These branches would have already been broken off.
Well, he told us he felt safe, but he also told us he saw 11 bears on his journey. So I guess he was a little more trusting of the bears than we were when we saw a bear. The only bear we've ever seen in all of our hiking was on the Appalachian Trail, of all places.
We didn't like that one at all, did we? We kind of backtracked along the trail to go back out of the woods another way.
So at the end of this long, long hike, you know, it had to end somewhere. Can you describe what it was like at the very end, getting to the top of that mountain in Maine and realizing that you had just completed the entire Appalachian Trail?
It didn't feel real. And I say that because I left with the intention of going out there and doing the whole trail. And yet I never felt like I was actually going to be able to follow through on that, to make it in 1 year. I felt like eventually I would finish the whole trail. I just didn't think that I would ever be able to navigate my way through that trail, because it is very difficult to walk that trail fully sighted and without vision. The number of times you fall and the number of chances you have to break a leg, break an arm, is just absolutely ridiculous. So it felt very surreal. And then at the same time, it was really sad, because when I finished with a number of people, and some of the people I'd been hiking with finished a couple days ahead of me. And the closest thing I can think of to describing it is our combat veterans, when, you know, they come back from war. And I was saying goodbye to people, some of whom I will never see again, yet we became so incredibly close because we relied on each other for our safety, and we were each other's source of entertainment. When you walk hours and hours and hours with people talking and telling your life story, and as you're walking, I think it strips off our filters, and so you have this just real honesty with people that we don't tend to have in the real world. And we laughed so much every day. And so the sadness of realizing it's over. We'd get on airplanes in 2 days and go home. That's it. Goodbye.
Well, what an incredible achievement. And I can imagine you end a journey like that with very mixed emotions. On the one hand, you feel very glad that you made this great achievement and ended. On the other hand, it's got to be sad to end because, as he said, you miss your friends and the experience.
Undaunted, Carl's planning some other long-distance hikes for next summer's hiking season. Maybe we'll talk to him next year and hear about those. Now for this week's high-tech item. What kind of technical aids Carl brought with him for this long-distance hike? You said you brought your phone with you. Is that the only piece of technology you had with you on the trip?
That was it.
And what did you use it for? Just phone calls, or were you actually able to use mapping software and anything else?
I could occasionally use mapping software. It was helpful. I went into New York City, and it was very helpful there. It was helpful in some of the other towns. The number one thing I used it for was to prevent boredom. And so I listened to about 175 hours of audiobooks a month for the first 3 months. And I would throw my one headphone in and I would walk. At first, it's hard to step away from regular society where you're constantly bombarded with music and news. And, you know, I'm a reader and I like to think, and you don't have a lot of intellectual stimulation out there, and sometimes you don't want to hear your own voices in your head because sometimes they're pretty negative. Listening to a book eliminated some of that for me, made it much more enjoyable, gave me something to talk about with people, and provide that intellectual stimulation I needed. The other thing I did with my phone is I would email. All of us texted up and down the trail, "Hey, I'm in this town, where are you?" And we kept tabs on each other that way. And then I would update to Facebook so that my friends and family would know where I was on the trail. And I had people that I had hiked with the previous year or people who I know that live on the East Coast that met me at various points along the trail.
Just out of curiosity, iPhone or Android?
Android. And I have two reasons why. The two reasons are that I traveled with about 100 gigabytes of audiobooks and music, and I would just switch my micro SD cards. You know, the iPhone cloud is great if you have an internet connection, but you chew through your batteries keeping your phone on an internet connection. I left my phone 90% of the time in airplane mode, and so my battery would last. You know, I could easily listen to 10 to 12 hours a day of books and music, and I had no issues with running out of power in my phone and still, you know, having enough juice to be able to text when I was standing on top of a mountaintop and I felt like I would have a signal. Those were the biggies for me.
Yeah. I guess the iPhones don't have the ability to swap SD cards and you're not going to fit 100 gigabytes in there.
They haven't sold that version yet.
Some of the other high-tech items that Carl brought with him were actually what he was wearing. Some of these modern fabrics are really incredible. Gore-Tex has been around for quite a while. We all know it's waterproof yet breathes, so you don't wind up just as wet on the inside as on the outside. But there's also a new fabric called Cuban, which is incredibly strong yet also incredibly lightweight. And if you're carrying everything you're planning to wear for the next several months, that's important too.
And how do you spell that?
Cuben. And how would people contact you if they want to ask you questions?
They can always contact me. You know, I'm always willing to talk to people. Easiest way would probably be to email me because I do travel quite a bit. And my email is bats, B-A-T-S, A-T-hike at gmail.com.
And if you want more information about hiking the Appalachian Trail, if this whetted your appetite and you might even consider doing it yourself, you can get lots and lots of information from the Appalachian Long Distance Hikers Association at aldha.org or the Appalachian Trail Conservancy at www.atconf.org. They provide lots and lots of useful information for prospective hikers. And oh, by the way, you don't have to hike the entire 2,200 miles. In fact, most people just hike a piece or two or three when they're out on a trip. And really, even some people who do the whole thing end to end do it in segments.
And as usual, if you missed any of those links, they'll be in the show notes at our website, www.viewpointsplus.net.
Well, that's it for show number 1244. Next week on Viewpoints, we'll be doing the first of a two-part mini-series about the iPhone. We finally gave up our flip phone in favor of his and hers iPhones. And we'll demonstrate and talk about basic accessibility of the iPhone using either VoiceOver with speech input or its low vision features next week. And the week after, we'll get into more detail and cover more advanced features, as well as some of our favorite apps. If you have any questions regarding something you've heard about on the show, or you'd like to share an idea for a future show, send an email to contact@viewpointsplus.net or call us at 585-258-0333 and we'll try to address your question in an upcoming program.
You've been listening to Viewpoints, hosted and produced by Nancy Goodman Torpey and Peter Torpey in partnership with WXXI Reach Out Radio. For detailed information or a full archive of programs, visit www.viewpointsplus.net. You can also follow us on Facebook or Twitter at Viewpoints Plus. We hope you'll join us again next week for more information and updates on products for accessible living. Thanks for listening to Viewpoints, and have a nice day.